You're listening to Radio Aryan at RadioAryan.com.
Mein Kampf by Adolf Hitler.
Volume 2, The National Socialist Movement. Of course, today we face the destructive barking of our nation's enemies at home. But we, National Socialists, should never be swayed from our course of proclaiming what is absolutely necessary based on our inherent convictions. It is true that we must endure the flow of public opinion, which has been misled by the cunning Jewish exploitation of German thoughtlessness. It is true that sometimes the waves around us roar with evil fierceness, but those who swim with the current are more easily overlooked than the one who swims against the current. Today we are just a rock sticking out of the flowing current. However, in a few years, fate will elevate us to become a dam which directs the flow of the current into a new riverbed. Therefore, it is necessary for the National Socialist Movement to be recognized and established in the eyes of the rest of the world as the representative of a definite political idea. Whatever heaven may have in store for us, let everyone know who we are by the caps we wear. As soon as we understand how greatly our intervention is needed in foreign policy, that is when this knowledge will make us absolutely determined and the strength of perseverance will flow through us. This strength will become important when one of us is under the drumming fire of the hostile pack of dogs known as the press, and he becomes frightened. This is the time he will feel the urge to make concessions here and there so that everyone is not against him, and in this moment he will want to howl with the wolves. Chapter 15. Self-Defense as a Right. When we laid down our arms in November 1918, it established a policy that anyone should have seen would gradually lead to a complete submission. Similar historical examples show that people who stop fighting without a compelling reason will eventually accept the greatest humiliation and demands rather than try to change their fate by using force again. This human quality is easily understandable. If at all possible, a wise conqueror will always impose his demands step by step on the conquered. He can count on the fact that a nation that has lost its strength of character, which is true of every nation that voluntarily surrenders, will not see a strong reason to reach for a weapon as each small separate act of oppression is forced upon them one at a time. The longer such demands are willingly accepted, the less the people see them as a reason to resist. When they consider the individual oppression, it seems unimportant when compared to the collective oppressions against them. Then they realize they have already tolerated much more and suffered a much greater misery in silence. So one more makes little difference. The downfall of Carthage is a terrible demonstration of how a people can become the victims of a slow execution brought about by their own fault. In his Three Beliefs, Clausewitz emphasizes this thought in a manner like no one else could, and immortalizes it when he says, "The strain of cowardly submission can never be wiped out. This drop of poison in the blood of a people is transmitted to posterity and will paralyze and undermine the strength of future organizations." And that, on the other hand, even the destruction of this freedom after a bloody and honorable struggle assures the rebirth of a nation. It is the essence of life from which a new tree is sure to take root sometime in the future. Of course, a nation that has lost its honour and character will not care about this doctrine. Whoever does take it to heart can never sink below a certain point. Only he who forgets or no longer chooses to acknowledge it can be broken down. Therefore, you cannot expect someone who has willingly surrendered their character and who is responsible for the submission of his people to suddenly repent and act differently than they did before simply because he is confronted by a logical statement or even as a result of his own experience. On the contrary, these are the people who will reject this very idea until either the population has become accustomed to their enslavement or until greater forces come along and take power from the hands of the current corrupter. In the first situation, these people do not feel miserable like they should because they are often given the job of overseeing the slaves by the clever conquerors. These people of weak character usually exercise this office without mercy over their own people, and it is much worse than any foreign bully who might be put into the same office by the enemy. Events in Germany since 1918 show that our hope to possibly gain the mercy of the victors through voluntary subjugation has unfortunately proven to be disastrous. This willing submission has caused the wide masses to form a fatal political notion. Here, I would like to emphasize the words wide masses, since I do not believe that all actions and the constant failure to act by our people's leaders can be credited to the same disastrous mistake. After the war, the direction of our fate changed, and it became obvious that it lay in the hands of Jews. You cannot possibly assume that a flawed understanding is the only cause of our misfortune. On the contrary, we must now be convinced that a conscious intention is destroying our people. As soon as one looks at the problem from this viewpoint, the obvious insanity in the foreign policy practiced by the leaders of our people becomes clear. It is actually the result of that highly cunning, ice-cold logic which serves the Jewish thought process and is part of their struggle for world conquest. Knowing this, it is then easy to understand why such a long period of time has elapsed without any improvement in our situation. To the contrary, in this time our state has steadily become weaker. This same span of time is comparable to that from 1806 to 1813, but in that case the time was sufficient to put the completely broken Prussia back together with new energy and a determination to fight. It has been 7 years since November 1918, and they just signed the Treaty of Locarno. Here is the sequence of events that we have experienced. After the disgraceful armistice was signed, no one had the energy or the courage to suddenly stand up and oppose the oppressive measures inflicted by the enemies, who returned over and over with more demands. The enemy, however, was clever enough not to ask for too much at any one time. They always limited their extortion to a level that they and our German leadership believed would be just enough to bear at the moment, so they did not have to fear a possible explosion of public opinion as a result. The more these individual demands were signed and choked down our throats, the less any resistance could be justified. This degradation was just one more extortion. So why would we suddenly do what had not been done so many times before? Why would we resist? This is the very drop of poison Clausewitz talks about when he mentions the first deed which lacks integrity. And it is this deed which is bound to grow until it gradually becomes the worst possible heritage, which hinders every future decision. This lack of character becomes a terrible lead weight that a people cannot shake off, and that ultimately pulls them down to become a race of slaves. In Germany, we faced disarmament and enslavement rulings. Our political system was made helpless, and we suffered economic plunder. All of these alternated until they finally produced a moral spirit that somehow could see the Dawes Plan as a blessing and mistook the Treaty of Locarno for a success. When viewing the situation from a higher point of view, we can see that at least one good thing has come out of this regrettable situation. it has been our good fortune that although men may have been deceived, heaven could not be bribed. For us, our blessing was misery and worry, which have since become the constant companions of our people, and misery is our only true ally. Fate has not chosen to make an exception in this instance. We are judged the same as all others, and because of this, fate handed out what we deserved. We may no longer know how to value honor, but we have at least learned to value freedom when it comes to bread. Our people have learned to cry for bread, and someday they will learn to pray for freedom. The bitter collapse of our people in the years after 1918 was apparent even before it arrived. At that time, anyone who dared to foretell what actually did take place was later violently persecuted. The leadership of our people was just as miserable as it was conceited. This was especially true when it came to removing disagreeable and undesirable prophets. At that time, it was likely to happen, and it is still happening today. And the greatest parliamentarians, those simple-minded straw heads who actually are members of the Glove Makers Guild and Master Saddle Makers, that is not to say their profession makes them dunces, it is simply that they have no training or experience in what they are trying to do, and they were suddenly elevated to the pedestal of a statesman and allowed to rebuke the ordinary mortals from their lofty heights. It made no difference that after 6 months of practicing his craftsmanship, such a statesman is generally revealed to be the most miserable good-for-nothing windbag, and he is then showered with scorn and ridicule by the rest of the world. By this time, he is at his wit's end. He doesn't know what to do next, and has already shown himself to be completely incompetent. That makes no difference to him. The more these parliamentary statesmen of this republic lack real accomplishments, the more furiously they persecute those who expect accomplishments from them, and those who have the audacity to expose their failure and predict their future failure. If anyone has cornered one of these parliamentary gentlemen, and if this tradesman can no longer deny that everything he has tried to do crumbled, then he finds thousands and thousands of excuses for his failures. One thing they will never admit, however, is that they are the main cause of all the evil themselves. During the winter of 1922-23, everyone should have seen the iron determination France displayed as she continued to pursue her original war aims, even after peace was declared. No one could believe that during 4.5 years of the most decisive struggle in her history, France would have risked the meager blood of her people simply to be compensated evenly for previous damages. Even the Alsace-Lorraine territory would not explain the energy driving French war tactics, not unless their aim was only part of a larger political program for the future of French foreign policy. This policy goal is the breakup of Germany into a jumble of small states. That was the real goal this fanatical patriot France fought for. But in going after this prize, she actually sold her people out as slaves to the international world Jew. This war goal of the French could have been achieved during the First World War if it had been fought on German soil as they had originally hoped in Paris. Let us suppose that the bloody battles of the First World War had not been fought on the Somme, in Flanders, in Artois, near Warsaw, Nizhny Novgorod, Kovno, Riga, and wherever else, but had been fought in Germany on the Ruhr, on the Main, on the Elbe, near Hanover, Leipzig, Nuremberg, etc. Then you quickly see that Germany's complete destruction would have been at hand. It is very doubtful that our young federal state of states would have endured the same difficult ordeal for 4.5 years as well as France did. France had been rigidly centralized for centuries and looked to the indisputable center, Paris, for leadership. The fact that this great struggle between nations took place outside the boundaries of our fatherland was to the immortal merit of the old army. But it was also the greatest piece of good fortune the future of Germany could have received. Though the idea sometimes causes me great suffering, it is my unshakable conviction that if the war were fought on German soil, the German Reich would have long since ceased to exist, and today nothing but a crowd of Germanic states would remain. This is the only reason why the bloodshed of our friends and brothers who have died on the battlefield has not been completely in vain. Fortunately for us, it turned out differently. Germany did collapse quickly in November 1918. But when the disaster happened at home, the armies of soldiers were still deep in enemy countries on the front lines. France's main concern at that time was not breaking up Germany, but how to rid France and Belgium of the German armies as quickly as possible. Therefore, the first task of Paris politicians was to disarm the German armies and to force them as quickly as possible back into Germany. Only after soldiers were out of their lands could they return to work on their original and real war aim. In this effort, however, France had already been paralyzed. For you see, England believed the war had been won the instant the colonial and commercial power had been destroyed and Germany had been reduced to the rank of a second-class state. Not only did England have no interest in destroying the German state completely, but she had every reason to see it become a future rival of France in Europe. The French policy had to continue during peacetime with stronger determination than what the war had started. Now, Clemenceau's declaration that, as far as he was concerned, peace was merely a continuation of the war had a greater significance. The fabric of the Reich was shaken at every opportunity. In Paris, they hoped that by imposing ever new reparation costs, disarmament demands, and through the economic damage those caused, they could gradually loosen the fabric of the Reich's structure. The more national honor died out in Germany, the sooner economic pressure and our unending need would cause political destruction. If this policy of political control, which trained our people to be submissive and of economic plunder, were pursued for 10 or 20 years, it would have ruined even the best state and would eventually dissolve it. The ultimate war goal of the French would have then been achieved. Everyone must have recognized this as France's intention long before the winter of 1922-23. Knowing this, there remained only two possibilities. One is that we could hope to blunt the will of the French with the toughness of the German people. The other is to finally do what must eventually take place, that is to turn the helm of the Reich's ship during some especially drastic situation and ram the enemy. This would mean a struggle for life and death, and the only chance we might have for life would be if we succeeded in isolating France before the struggle, and isolate her well enough so that this second conflict would not be a struggle of Germany against the world, but a defense of Germany against France, which was constantly disrupting world peace. I must emphasize that I am firmly convinced this clash will eventually come, either in one way or another. I could never be convinced that France's intention towards us will change. Their actions are deeply rooted in the French nation's thoughts of self-preservation. If I were a Frenchman, and if the greatness of France was as dear to me as the greatness of Germany truly is sacred to me, then I would act no differently from Clemenceau. The French race is gradually dying out, not only in the number of her people, but especially in regard to her best racial elements. France can only retain her continued importance in the world through the destruction of Germany. French policy may make a thousand detours, but somewhere at the end, this will always exist as the ultimate goal. It is their greatest desire and deepest longing. It would be a mistake to think that a purely passive will, seeking to preserve itself, can withstand an active attack from an enemy with an equal or stronger will in the long run. The everlasting conflict between Germany and France will never be decided as long as that conflict is limited to a German defense against French aggression. Century after century, German borders will continue to fall back farther and farther. If you look at the wandering frontier that defines the German language from the 12th century up till the present time, you will lose faith in the old attitude of development, because you will see, up to this time, it has caused us so much harm. This must be made clear in Germany, so we will no longer allow the German nation's will to live to degenerate into a mere passive defense, but rather concentrate this will toward an active confrontation with France and use it in a final decisive battle so we can reach the greatest ultimate goals for Germany. Only then will we be able to end the eternal and fruitless struggle between Germany and France. Through the destruction of France, Germany can finally give our people the means to expand. Today, there are 80 million Germans in Europe. After 100 years, when there are 250 million Germans on this continent, this foreign policy will be appreciated much more. Our people will not be crowded together like factory coolies working for the rest of the world, but we will be farmers and workers who use their labor to support each other and help their fellow man earn a living. In December 1922, the friction between Germany and France had again reached a dangerous peak. France had her eye on new, unprecedented extortions and needed a way to justify them. Political pressure led the way for this economic plunder, and the French believed only a violent grip on the nerve center of our entire German livelihood would be sufficient to put these unruly people under a heavier yoke of burden. France hoped the occupation of the Ruhr territory would not only break Germany's morale backbone, but that it would also force us into an economic position where we would have to accept even the heaviest obligations, willy-nilly, whether we wanted it or not. It was a matter of bending or breaking. In the beginning, Germany bent, only to break completely at the end. The occupation of the Ruhr caused fate to once more reach out to Germany, offering her an opportunity to rise again. What at first looked like a terrible misfortune proved on closer examination to be the great promise of the possibility to end all of Germany's suffering. The occupation of the Ruhr had, for the first time, deeply alienated England from France. It was not only British diplomatic circles who entered and maintained this alliance with their eyes wide open and based their decisions on cold, logical calculation who disliked these events, but this occupation also estranged large circles among the English people. The English business world felt the continental strengthening of France's power the most, and they had an obvious resentment. Aside from the fact that France now occupied a military position in Europe that Germany had not enjoyed even before the war, she also gained economic resources that practically gave France an economic monopoly. The greatest iron and coal mines in Europe were now united in the hands of a nation that, unlike Germany, had looked after her own interests in a decisive and active manner. And this was a nation that had reminded the world of its military ability during the Great War. And here again, their action caused alarm all over the world. France's occupation of the Ruhr and the coal mines deprived England of all her diplomatic success. Now the industrious and active British diplomacy was no longer the winner, but Marshal Foch and the French he represented was the winner. Italy's relations with France had not been exactly rosy since the end of the war. However, feelings toward Italy now turned into outright hatred. This was the great historical moment when former allies might be future enemies. The fact that this did not happen, and that the Allies did not suddenly fight among themselves, like what happened during the Second Balkan War, is due to the fact that Germany had no Enver Pasha, but merely a Chancellor Kuno. The invasion of the Ruhr territory by the French opened up great possibilities for Germany's future in terms of our foreign and domestic policies. A large number of our people were suddenly cured of the delusion which was fueled by the lying press that France was the champion of progress and liberty. The spring of 1923 became just like 1914, when all the dreams that there existed an international solidarity between nations were banished from the minds of our German workers. Suddenly they were brought back to the world of eternal struggle. Everywhere we can see how one being fed upon another and the death of the weaker means life for the stronger. When the French carried out their threats and finally began to march into the German coal territory, though at first they did so with great caution and hesitation, A decisive hour for Germany had struck.
To Radio Aryan.